I don't need to introduce my first guest, brilliant journalist, former BBC journalist, radio presenter, geopolitical analyst. Check out The Politics Show on BCFM. It's a terrific weekly show if you haven't heard it before. More info on that at thisweek.org.uk. Also check out bilderberg.org. Let's welcome back to the show our good friend Tony Gosling. Tony, welcome back.
Hi, Richie. Thanks for asking me on again.
It's an honour to have you on. Let's get straight into the madness of the news that we learned. I think you might have alerted me to it, that Colonel Alison McCourt, the most senior nurse in the British Army, has been all over the world, has worked in military installations near Salisbury. She happened to be the first person on the scene to tend to the stricken Skripals 10 months ago. Amazing story. We only know this because her daughter spilled the beans by contacting local radio to recommend her mummy get a hero's award. The Russians are laughing their backsides off, Tony. What's going on?
Well, okay, so I was working in Salisbury for the BBC as a reporter when Spire FM was set up. This is in the early 1990s. And, you know, I was obviously, a lot of us were interested to see what is this organisation going to do. Well, anyway, at the weekend, they had their annual award ceremony. And that's the only reason we know. It's because this colonel, this most senior colonel nurse in the British Army, was actually right on the scene when this so-called Salisbury poisoning was happening. And there's that one, there's a wonderful picture that RT have posted on their website of her. I mean, I do have to look at it twice, blink and say, has this been photoshopped? Because there she is, stood outside in her army uniform. Actually, her, I have to say her cap is a little bit wonky, but maybe, you know, she hasn't been under too much discipline in the army to make sure her cap is straight. But she's got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 medals pinned on her chest. I'm not sure how many times she's been in battle and risked her life and which, how many campaigns she's had. But this is the person who was on the scene with her daughter just as the Skripal thing happened almost a year ago. And we only know because Spire FM, bless them, gave an award ceremony for her daughter. Up until now, these two had been kept strictly anonymous.
Absolutely incredible. Polly Boyko, reporting for RT this afternoon, says the Russians are demanding access. You know, they're still demanding access to witnesses. They're demanding access to the Skripals to, you know, to prove they're alive and well, and that they'd also like to speak to Alison McCourt. It just gets curiouser and curiouser. Can we dismiss this now, Tony? You see, you're a proper journalist, and you'll never go all in. You'll always allow a little bit of room for reasonable doubt. But can we just go all in now and say this is the one of the hoaxes of the century?
Well, it's just another piece of evidence that this is not what we've been told it is. I mean, it's just an incredible coincidence. The other incredible coincidence is that just 10 minutes drive down the road from where it happened a year ago, whatever did happen, is is alive, not decommissioned, which is true for most of them in the world, a live, active chemical and biological warfare base, the central place in the whole of the United Kingdom where all these substances are concentrated. It's just 10 minutes drive down the road at Portendown. And this proximity of this base to where this incident happened is another coincidence that hasn't been reported. There's, I would suggest, something like 20-25 coincidences. My copper's hunch is the whole thing is a psyop concocted by the British intelligence services. I would imagine that she is probably an undercover intelligence officer. I mean, obviously she is a qualified nurse, but you know, this is the way these things work. You can meet somebody who's in the army at whatever rank, whatever level, and you will find that secretly they're also an intelligence officer who has another agenda. That is exactly what she looks like to me. And as I say, there are something like 20-25 different coincidences that we're supposed to associate with this. Another one of which is the police report a couple of weeks before this incident of fentanyl in the area. So that is a very toxic form of heroin, which was circulating apparently by illegal drug dealers. in the Salisbury area, and they were warning of that. And that looks to me as if this is what Charlie Rowley and his girlfriend probably consumed. Nothing to do with Novichok, because as we know, Novichok kills. Charlie Rowley actually said, Richie, and I'm sure you remember as well as I do, he said, I got the stuff all over my
hands. That's right, all over his hands.
Now,
yeah.
Literally a pinprick of this stuff is enough to kill you.
Yeah.
I've spoken since then to several experts, one who'd worked for many years in chemical weapons, and they're all just shake their heads and say, well, the public must be very, very ignorant if they buy this story, because this stuff surely we should be seeing at least 300 or 400 people dead if this stuff had got out. But no, it's all over the hands of Charlie Rowley, and he's all right. Plus the two Skripals, they're okay, and they've disappeared in a puff of purple smoke off the face of the earth. All very handy, but this is all just grist to the mill to throw mud at Russia, which is what we've been doing for many years now, not least of which is the invasion of Afghanistan, which has effectively meant that NATO is surrounding Russia. So Russia is the target, Russia is the enemy, and lots of time and money is being spent on psychological warfare to make everybody hate Russia. A kind of predictive programming for a potential forthcoming war with Russia. So what we've seen happening to Gaddafi in Libya, what we've seen happening to Assad in Syria, what we saw happening to Saddam Hussein, they're now trying it on with Putin. And I think they're going to get their hands burnt. And let's just hope not too many of us go down at the same time, because we can't have Britain at war with Russia.
No.
Simply not going to happen.
No, the phony war. Brilliant stuff, Tony. I want to say, just before we get into the next item, if you're a budding journalist, if you happen to be, you know, starting out in, whether it's at college, at a course, or whether you're at uni and you're doing journalism, you could do a lot worse than pay attention to somebody like Tony Gosling. I'm going to give you an example now of what I mean by that. To be a journalist, to be a really good journalist and a reporter, you've got to have an innate sense of curiosity about everything. You've got to be genuinely interested in everything. You've got to want to listen to everything. And when you do, you end up like Tony Gosling, and you start to see things that people don't see. You said to me the other day, I thought it was amazing. I didn't get this at all, because I just didn't get it. You got it. There was a bombing, folks, in Derry last Saturday. That's a very serious thing for people in the six counties. You know, a very worrying thing. News of a bombing, a car bombing. It happened outside the courthouse on Bishop Street. And, you know, it's been reported on pretty heavily. You know, it was apparently meant to kill people. It was, the new IRA was blamed for it. But Tony Gosling is a smart man. He looks at it from about 100 different angles. The security services released some pictures of it blowing up, Tony, but there's a lot about the pictures that the security services, they didn't give us the full picture, did they? And I'm very interested in this as we're talking about the backstop and the potential for a hard border in Ireland, which has been ramped up this afternoon by the European Union saying, going against the Irish government for the first time in the process, saying that there will be a hard border after March 29th. I wonder about that bomb last Saturday. You're not happy with the coverage of it. You're not happy with the UK media analysis of it. Go ahead.
Well, not at all. And I'm not happy with the coverage of Brexit either at all, because what we've got is we've got Parliament basically trying to stop Brexit. We you know, the British people, for right or wrong, maybe wrong, voted for Brexit. And therefore, if those parliamentarians, the people we elected, are servants of the people, then they will implement that decision. Quite clearly, there's a majority of MPs that are not servants of the people. They're not interested in that. They have their own agendas, possibly on the way to nice careers in the City of London and that sort of thing. And also, let's say that nowadays, if you're a politician that fails, you might well find yourself with a very nice job and an incredible pension deal at the European Commission or one of the other EU institutions. So what they do is they pick up people who've campaigned pro-EU over the years, who get booted out by the electorate, and they give them nice jobs and nice salaries. But look, with the backstop, it's obvious to me. I actually spoke to the DUP about this a couple of times, and I still cannot make sense of their policy. They're saying, well, they don't want a border between Southern and Northern Ireland, but then they also don't want a border between Northern Ireland and England. Now, to me, Richie, that doesn't make sense.
Ridiculous.
You can't be in both countries at the same time. In other words, you can't be a sort of ramp where people can get into Southern Ireland and then come through with no checks into England if they're both two separate countries. You're going to have a border somewhere. So really, the DUP have just got to make their mind up. And I think, you know, it's going to be almost certainly they're going to say, well, we're going to have a hard border. Now, that doesn't mean to say a very hard border. You might allow people through with just a cursory look at a passport or whatever and no checks on their cars, that sort of thing, and just pull people over that you feel suspicious about. And you may have to have good reason to feel suspicious about. Even, you know, that sort of thing is quite normal. I mean, I lived right on the border for a year or so back in the 90s before the Good Friday Agreement. And we had a very, very, very hard border with soldiers pointing guns at you and only one vehicle allowed anywhere near the border at a time.
Yeah.
In fact, sometimes it would take nearly half an hour just to get through the border. And there were queues of cars and this sort of thing. That won't be the case in the future. But that, I think, is what we're looking at here. I also noticed, Richie, I don't know if you picked up on this, but in the Belfast Telegraph, there's been a couple of articles over the last year, because this whole backstop and Irish border issue has been raised over a year ago. And it's one of the reasons that David Davis wasn't happy and resigned as Brexit secretary. So what they said was, this border is going to happen because it's part of the Good Friday Agreement. Well, apparently, according to the Belfast Telegraph and according to several leading lawyers and parliamentarians in the north, it's not. So there's no reason in that, apparently. I mean, I haven't looked through all the text, but there is certainly some very strong evidence that it's not a problem for the Good Friday Agreement to have a border. I would suggest probably not manned by the parachute regiment. That probably
absolutely
would be a good idea. But some sort of border, I think, is going to be almost necessary if this Brexit is going to happen, because that's what I can't keep coming back to. Is Brexit going to be allowed to happen? Do the parliamentarians serve the people, or do they just see us as people to be managed? And if they do see us as people to be managed and our opinions to be managed, then I'm really worried about the future, because this could be a real crisis if they try and overturn this whole referendum. In fact, I'd also add to all of this that many of the Remainers, I wouldn't say all of them, but many of them I've spoken to, have said, well, look, we've had a vote on it and we've decided, and they just want to see the decision implemented. They agree with the democratic decision. If the majority say that they want to leave, then many of the Remainers actually just want to get it over with and leave anyway. So what you've got is more than half saying we want to leave. You've also got a substantial proportion of the people that voted Remain also saying, look, let's just get on and leave. And yet all of the mass media is saying is the opposite. And most of the parliamentarians are saying the opposite. So I think we've just got a real genuine political drama on our hands, and it's anyone's guess as to what will happen on the 29th of March.
Yeah, really good analysis of the backstop thing. It was a figment of the imagination of the European Union. It's a nonsense. There isn't any appetite whatsoever politically or amongst the peoples of the north or south of the border to return to the brilliantly described days of the parachute regiment. I experienced that myself only a couple of times. Once when I was a teenager, when I went to stay in Banbridge in County Down as part of a Cooperation North school children thing, and it wasn't pleasant. It was nasty, and nobody has any appetite to go back to that. There's no need for it whatsoever. Brilliantly described. Let's talk about Tony Gosling is our guest. Thisweek.org.uk, Bilderberg.org. Check out Tony, top journalist. The Politics Show weekly on BCFM is a must listen. Check it out if you haven't checked it out before. You're watching very closely events in France, the Gilets Jaunes, and you're talking about Brexit, which I never believed from day one would ever be implemented, for reasons that I'm not going to get into now, because I spend most of my monologues explaining what I believe the European Union to be. Are we going to see reciprocal grassroots protests growing in number here, like the Gilets Jaunes? I ask you, because you're watching this and reporting on it all the time. What do you think?
Well, I don't know if the British character is anything really like the French. The French are sort of socialist at heart, in a way. I mean, I think it's fair to say that, I mean, I think it was, must have been the late 1990s when I was over there. And there was some, I think it was maybe when Chirac came to power. I'm not quite sure who the president was. But anyway, it was a move to the right. And people are in the street and they just approach you. I mean, they didn't know I couldn't speak French, but they're saying, oh, socialism and more. Yeah. You know, like, they're really passionate about the idea that the state is there to serve the people, and that also to redistribute resources. In other words, to make sure that there's nobody that's really poverty stricken and completely without, and also to make sure that the rich pay their tax. And of course, this hasn't been happening right across the Eurozone. The rich have been shifting their money here, there, and everywhere, Cayman Islands, etc. And I'm not just talking about rich individuals down in Monaco or Monte Carlo. I'm talking also about the corporations, the big corporations who are selling, are basically taking over the markets of France. So the reason that many of the small businesses and small shopkeepers are having to sell up and close their businesses is because we're in the era of the transnational corporations. And they are past masters, Richie, not paying tax. They'll pay little amounts, piffling amounts, and they'll sometimes pay fines because they've calculated that a criminal activity is only likely to get them a small fine, and they can make more profit out of the criminal activity anyway. So what we're seeing is a kind of criminalization, particularly of the banking sector, and also, of course, that trickles down to other sectors too. But the French are really getting angry about this, quite genuinely, over those lovely meals they have, the long meals. I don't know how much time you spent over there, but a family I was with, we spent, I think it was a Saturday, we started eating at about midday, and we didn't finish until about 10 o'clock in the evening.
That's right.
It was just one rolling meal with another course, some music, a different wine would be served. Fantastic. I mean, fantastic.
And the salad at the end, Tone. Don't forget the salad at the end. The salad comes at the end for our listeners who don't know this. No, I, to be honest, I've not spent a great deal of time there at all, despite my better half being from Nancy, and she's as French as stripy t-shirts and onions around your neck. But those, what a description of the meal. You're absolutely bang on. We're getting loads of tweets and questions. I don't want to be interrupting you, but you're on this theme, and I'd like to stay with the theme because you're on a roll here.
Listen, I want to also say one other thing, which is just looking at some of the demands of the Gilets Jaunes, because these are really important things, I think, to get our heads around. There's a lot of attempt to turn it into some far-right thing. I've seen quite close friends of mine
actually buying
some of this nonsense. Oh, I've seen Tommy Robinson with a yellow jacket on. The yellow vests movement is absolutely solidly socialist. What I'm saying that for is to make it absolutely clear what they're demanding. They're demanding that the rich pay their tax. They're also demanding Frexit. They're saying Brussels is not working. The euro is not working. We want the franc back and we want to get out of the European Union. Now, there's not just one of them saying this. These are the collective decisions which are coming out from the French. So we need to be really clear about what they're calling for. They're calling for a kind of social revolution over there. The other thing is, they are also calling Macron the imposter. We've had enough of this guy. We know he's an imposter. And, of course, you know what he is? He's a Bilderberg.
He's a Rothschild. That's right.
Well, Bilderberg imposter. We've seen these time and time again. Someone that turns up, no one's ever heard of them before, at a Bilderberg conference. And then within a couple of years, they've suddenly got enough money behind them and support from maybe from an existing political party, not in Macron's case, to then become prime minister. We had this with Bill Clinton. We had it with Tony Blair. I mean, there's countless people who've come to power after being tapped up at a Bilderberg conference. And Macron is very much one of those. The French have seen right through it. And congratulations for them.
The Sunday Telegraph, I reported on this on Sunday View on Sunday. The Sunday Telegraph had an exclusive. It was a marvellous bit of journalism. They obtained the audio recording of a conference call between the Brexit secretary, whoever he is these days, and Philip Hammond. And they were on with 300 of the captains of industry. And as I was reporting this on Sunday, I channeled my inner Tony Gosling and I asked my audience, was that a mini Bilderberg meeting where Hammond was promising these businesses, don't worry about it, we won't leave the European Union? What was going on there? 300 of the biggest firms in the country and around Europe, including Siemens, including Amazon. And Hammond was on a conference call with them only a few minutes after May's deal was defeated in Parliament. And he was saying, don't worry about it, there won't be any hard Brexit, we'll get a deal or we'll stay in or whatever. And I thought of you. I thought they were having a mini Bilderberg meeting there. Go ahead.
They are. And I mean, it just shows you that the people who are in the key position, particularly the Treasury, obviously that is a very important position, some ways more important than Theresa May. She's almost like the, you know, the one that gets rolled out to do the press conference or whatever, the PR person. Now, Philip Hammond behind the scenes is the one who's controlling where our tax money goes. So the rich and powerful want to have him on a leash. They want to have a spiky dog collar around his neck, and they want to be able to pull it at any particular moment when they want him to say what he's supposed to say. And the public have got very, very little say in you know, the Treasury and what they do. We also had, I don't know if you remember this from a couple of years ago, Richie, but we had evidence. Well, you know, it's quite clear. KPMG, PricewaterhouseCoopers had their own spies within the Treasury.
Right, yeah.
They had actually interns and people in there who were just finding out what the Treasury was up to. The reason they do that is because these groups, these financial services firms, who, by the way, audit each other, just take a deep breath and think about that for a minute.
Yeah, they do.
KPMG auditing PricewaterhouseCoopers and vice versa, right? So they had people in there who would be keeping a very close eye on any kind of Treasury policy which might mean taxing the rich and taxing the big corporations so that they could then make counter moves against it. So the Treasury's captured, I would say, almost 100%. I wouldn't say the Bank of England is.
You're killing me here. You're killing me here. They've had spies, and I remember you reporting on that. We talked about this. They had spies, these massive corporations in the Treasury. And guess what? The UK media is obsessed with whether or not the Leeds soccer manager was spying on opposition players. But they couldn't give a shit about the fact that the Treasury is compromised. But they'll talk all day about the Leeds boss sending spies to opposition training grounds. We live in a lunatic asylum, Tony.
We do. And I mean, look, some of the sanity is coming right now from the yellow vests in France. They're talking about no more planned obsolescence. You know, ending this whole idea that you buy something and, you know, a few minutes after its guarantee runs out, the thing falls apart. I've had this quite a lot with, particularly with electronic goods, that they almost seem as if they've got a little timer inside them. As soon as the either 1 year or 2 year guarantees runs out, the thing just stops working.
Yeah.
They're also talking about banning plastic bottles and all sorts of polluting packaging. We've seen now, even is Malaysia and the Philippines have now banned us sending recycled plastic there because all they've got is mountains and mountains and mountains of untreated recycled plastic, and they've had enough of it. So this whole recycling thing is not working. So they're saying, look, let's just ban the plastic stuff. You know, we don't need it. We don't want it. We never did. In fact, we always used to say as kids, oh, it's from Hong Kong, it must be plastic. You know, and those were in the days when things were made of metal or wood or, you know, things that weren't plastic. Also, they want to weaken, it's a really important one, this, weaken the influence of the big pharmaceutical industries on health in general and hospitals in particular. I was just looking the other day, Richie, another vaccine, not MMR, that's administered, which is another one of these vaccines which has got several vaccines all mixed into one. And there's been no testing at all of the potential combination of those vaccines when injected together. So the individual vaccines have been tried and tested and approved as individual vaccines. But what they're doing is they're injecting them all in at the same time and saying, oh, well, it's OK, it's all approved. Of course, that isn't the case. And if you go back to anyone, speak to anyone who suffered from Gulf War syndrome back in 1990, you will find that is exactly what the army were doing. They were doing multiple injections of different vaccines, different substances, in order to warn against possible chemical attack or biological attack. And there were literally hundreds of our servicemen that got terrible illnesses of various sorts, some of them terminal, many of them lasted with them for the rest of their lives, things like problems with eyesight, all sorts of things from this Gulf War syndrome. And that's all Gulf War syndrome was, at least that's my belief, is just trying to combine all these different things at once, injecting them all together, and the body just says, hang on, what are you doing?
Yeah, that's
stop
right.
It, you know, and it can't cope.
Number of doctors have been on this programme, that's GPs, not alternative practitioners, but GPs have been on to say over the years, to say exactly what Tony said there. Tony Gosling is our guest, thisweek.org.uk. So what about the potential for a movement like the Gilets Jaunes movement? I'm taking it at face value. I love the ideas about referendums, you know, people's referendums. Love all these ideas and the demands that you've been describing there yourself. What about the potential for movements like this to be
subverted? Well, you would expect something like that to come somehow broadly through the left.
Yeah.
Okay, but what's happened with Jeremy Corbyn, oh my God, it has been some sort of meltdown in his brain. I don't know what's going on, but he's certainly, he doesn't understand a few basic things. I'm afraid I think he's just being steered by his MPs, the Blairite MPs, into following Tony Blair policies, like having a second referendum, this sort of thing. And it's actually quite concerning to see he does not understand the basics of the demographics of the vote. I was just looking up a Guardian article the other day. I tweeted it out yesterday about the poverty of the areas that voted Leave. Now, these are natural Labour voters. And yet he seems to have just shrugged that off and, oh, well, never mind. No. We're going to go with any kind of excuse or attempt to remain. So voting against even a deal which May has put together, which is a half and half deal, he's trying to stop that. And he's sort of bleating about having a general election. I'm sorry, but if there's a general election, it's no way is Jeremy Corbyn going to be involved in that decision. It's going to be Theresa May and the grandees of the Conservative Party, because the DUP have already said if there's any votes of no confidence, they'll vote with the Tories. And so he's actually pissing in the wind, if I can say that.
He is.
I don't know where his ideas and policy are coming from. So that's why I think the left is really in disarray. And that's natural when you're half infiltrated with Blairites who've got no interest in the left, really, who are just successors to Margaret Thatcher operating within the Labour Party. So I can't see that happening with Labour. I can certainly see something happening on the left with the Greens. But you see, they aren't really that organised in any stretch of the imagination. They don't look at things like the wider implications of industrial policy, of monetary policy. And so I think that the left in the UK has been effectively paralysed, not just naturally by people being silly, but also deliberately by infiltration. And we know that the big groups like Militant and the Socialist Workers Party have been incredibly heavily infiltrated by MI5. So look, basically the rich and powerful have done their homework in Britain, and they've seen that some of these fringe left-wing groups could be a real threat, certainly in getting people out on the streets, like, for example, groups like the People's Assembly and CND have done over the years. There are quite a few groups that can do this, but pretty much all of those have been paralysed, by infiltration. And the evidence for that is in a book, very strong evidence, particularly about the SWP, in Defending the Realm, I think it's called, which is a book about David Shaler and Annie Machon, which was published in, I think, the very late 1990s. It says something like 30 of the top people in the Socialist Workers Party were working directly for MI5.
That's right. I've not had an opportunity in 10 years to say this to you, and I might not again, but I told you so, Jeremy Corbyn. Jeremy Corbyn is not a socialist. He's a left social Democrat. He doesn't really have a genuine socialist bone in his body. He never was, and he never will be.
Well, okay, but I mean, he is. He does have his hands tied, and because you know why? Because he has said, "Look, I want to have a broad church here, and I want everyone to have their view to speak out." Well, that actually is not a very good way to lead. You've got to actually capture the zeitgeist of the party, and you've got to be able to make decisions on the fly, knowing that you're members and your MPs, which might not necessarily be the same constituency at all, are going to support you. And I just don't think he's able to do that. That's not the sort of leader he is. He thinks he's running some kind of a different, should we say, some sort of hippie kind of an organisation where everyone's just nice to each other. Well, I'm afraid politics isn't like that. He needs to just get, I think, much tougher with his party. But there's nothing he can do about the MPs. They're there ensconced and actually working against him. Many of them are trying to undermine him. I mean, we had one of our Bristol MPs, Darren, can't remember his second name anyway, for Bristol North West, saying, I think Jeremy Corbyn is behind in the polls. This is all at the time when the other half of the party is moaning about the BBC criticising Diane Abbott on BBC's Question Time. Right? At the same time, you've got another MP saying, well, actually, Corbyn is behind in the polls and it's a bit embarrassing. And the other half of the party is, so they're not on message. They're not keeping their act together. There's very little party discipline. And many of the MPs, they seem to be actually treading water, Richie, doing virtually nothing. And they certainly won't be part of a Jeremy Corbyn cabinet. So he's having a real hard time. And the fact that he's being steered against negotiating with Theresa May, etc., at the moment, to just try and score political points out of the whole Brexit problem we've got running up to the 29th of March. It's also meaning that many people are looking at him, shaking their heads and saying, well, I'm not voting for him again.
Let me see what you just said and raise it, and then I'll give you the final word on that for today. I'll see what you said and I'll raise you. He has a massive mandate from the membership, and when they tried to get rid of him, his own MPs, only 18 months or 2 years ago, he mopped the floor with him. So theoretically, he shouldn't give a wet fart what the Blairite MPs in Parliament do. He should be strong enough to stand up to it and say, well, no, I'm sorry, this is where we're going. I put it to you, and I'll give you the final word. Thanks for coming back, T. It's brilliant having you back. I put it to you, final word to you, that he doesn't do what is fairly easy for him to do, because he's either a champagne socialist or a left social democrat. He's not genuine. Never has been, in my opinion.
Well, I just have to disagree. I think he's just unable to discipline his MPs. He cannot. He's already told them, you know, listen, we've got to do this and we've got to do that. They just ignore him. In fact, what happens is when he tries to discipline his Blairite MPs, which is the majority of Labour MPs at the moment, then they just start undermining him. They'll go on to one of these politics programmes, criticise him. And, you know, so he's at war with his own party. And this is exactly, of course, what the big business wants, the banks want. They're rubbing their hands with glee because they can see that although he's a leader in name, he's got no power to actually get his MPs to vote one way or another. And many of them are spending most of their time, you know, trying to keeping their jobs, but undermining him at the same time. Look, one of the things, though, we did mention the bomb in Derry. We didn't really talk about the footage enough, because I think it's quite important. Is it all right if I get into this now, Richie?
Yeah, we've got about 3-4 minutes left.
Really quick. All I'm saying is I'm making the point that, yes, last night they did release the footage, but for the first couple of nights when they had the CCTV footage on the news all around the world, they were showing footage of the car arriving outside Derry Courthouse that had been hijacked and had a bomb inside it, and they showed people walking past the car. And then they showed the car blowing up. What they didn't show was the actual bomber or bombers getting out of the car. Now, this to me is incredibly bizarre, because you would surely, I mean, whatever clothes they're wearing, they showed it last night. And the guy, it looked like a bloke, was wearing black clothes. But surely straight away, you should be, you know, if I'm a police officer, I should be putting out information to the public saying, look, here is the person. Can anyone identify him by his clothes, by the way he walks, or anything like that? But they didn't do that. And this is what makes me think that potentially this is just simply a scare tactic by the security services. And by the way, the main amendments to the whole Brexit vote decision are being made by Dominic Grieve. Dominic Grieve is the chairman of the Intelligence and Security
Committee.
Indeed he is. So he is the closest person to the security services, and nobody seems to be pointing this out. Every time you hear about Dominic Grieve, the Dominic Grieve amendment, people should be thinking instantly, right, this is what MI5 and MI6 want, not what we want.
Brilliant to have you back, mate. Folks, check out thisweek.org.uk, The Politics Show, Fridays on BCFM. Top man, Tony, Bilderberg.org. Thanks for your time today, mate. I really appreciate it. And I'll be in touch real soon about getting you back. Thanks, Tony.
Thanks, Richie. God bless.
Always brilliant. You too, mate. Tony Gosling there in Bristol, folks. Check him out, thisweek.org.uk. Loads of tweets on that. Go to twitter.com, where it says, search Twitter, put Richie Allen Show, but no spaces, just one word, Richie Allen Show. If you press enter, you'll see what other people are tweeting me, and I'm getting lots of tweets on it. All right, your Richie Allen Show, 6:02. You've done it. Steve Harley, Make Me Smile on the Richie Allen Show, 6:04, Tuesday, January 22nd, 2019. Welcome back to the programme. A lot of comments on Tony Gosling and what we were talking about. Lots and lots of comments. Kim says, great to hear Tony's take on things. Great guest, says Kim. Patrick says, there is also the Labour membership that Jeremy Corbyn has to consider, who are allegedly also in favour of a people's vote. He is truly screwed unless he grows a pair and takes the fifth columnist on and appeals to the membership. As I said, a multitude of comments on that at Richie Allen Show on Twitter. Now, my next guest is no stranger to you either. He's a top man, one of the co-founders of the Scottish Socialist Party and Solidarity, former member of the Scottish Parliament. Love having him on. You can read him these days if you go to sputniknews.com. That's sputniknews.com. He's a terrific geopolitical analyst, and his articles are thought-provoking and shot through with facts and very interesting questions. It's always brilliant to welcome him back to the show. Let's say hi again to Tommy Sheridan. Tommy, welcome back. How are you?
Richie, I'm great, mate, and it just shows you how much a tenner can buy nowadays, because that was a fantastic introduction, mate, and it was money well spent by me.
So thanks very much. You're a typical jock. I thought we said 20. There you are, but it'll have to be 10. It'll have to be 10 then.
It's the value of the pound, mate. It's going down.
It is, isn't it?
Right as we speak.
Everything is going down. I was when I put out this morning on Twitter that you were coming back on, you're one of those guests that I know I'm going to get emails with people saying, Richie, put it to Tommy. Richie, put it to Tommy. Richie, put this to Tommy. Before we talk about independence for Scotland, before we talk about hunting, which I want to get into as well, that disgusting practice that still goes on here, and you wrote a brilliant piece on that, sputniknews.com, I was asked to put to you, honest to God, I will forward you the emails, number of emails, all on Nicolas Maduro and Venezuela. Now, I would have given anything to interview Hugo Chavez. In fact, I got very close. They agreed to bring him on my program in Spain many years ago with an interpreter, and then he was unwell, and then they said, oh, well, maybe it's best he didn't do it. But I was desperate to get him on because I have an awful lot of time for Hugo Chavez, as I know you do. What's happening in Venezuela? That's what I was asked to put to you. Are we seeing Venezuela, the project, the Bolivarian philosophies, real socialism, are we seeing it in its death throes because of external influences, namely the United States and her allies? Are we seeing Venezuela in real trouble? I was asked to put that to you, my friend, by a half a dozen people today. Go ahead.
Richie, I had the pleasure of grasping and shaking Hugo Chavez's hand in 2003, and although I didn't get to interview him, I got to interview his vice president at the time, Jose Vicente Rangel, who was the founder of the Young Communist League in Venezuela, and who was an absolute delight and full of wisdom and knowledge, not just about Venezuela, but about the whole of Latin America. And what is quite clear is the sheer and utter grotesque hypocrisy of the United States is writ large in the name of Venezuela, because this is a country, America, that tells us that they need to build a wall to keep people out because they don't want anybody interfering in their affairs, but they are busily interfering in the affairs of Venezuela to try and engender an overthrow of an elected government, over and over, democratically elected government, former bus driver Nicolas Maduro, who was the chosen one of Hugo Chavez before he died. He has been democratically elected on at least three occasions, and yet all America does is try and impose economic sanctions, try and finance opposition groups to create economic chaos and mess in order to try and destabilize that country. Now, fortunately, for many years, countries like Bolivia and Chile have stuck by Venezuela and Cuba and tried to ensure that that country wasn't destabilized. What happened recently, of course, with the election of the proto-fascist in Brazil, is that America now has an ally in the region, and they are using that ally to further the destabilization process. All I can do as any socialist and Democrat across the world's got to do is hope that the Venezuelan people are not going to be brought under the iron heel of some right-wing dictatorship. They're not going to swallow the garbage of things will be better if you overthrow this government. Because the reason the Venezuelan people are suffering isn't anything to do with Maduro or the socialist government. It's to do with economic sanctions that America is imposing on that country. So it is a disgrace that America is interfering in that region.
You know, I try and explain this to people, and there are, I'm lucky enough that I do get some conservative commentators who come on the programme, and they're nice people, and that's in no way to patronise them at all, you know, as if that I know more than they do, I don't, but I bring them on and I argue the points you've argued, I make the case that you have made brilliantly there that the sanctions are the reasons why at times there are not enough things in the supermarket and, you know, there might be a shortage of painkilling medications and sanitary products in the pharmacies. But the media in the West is relentless in playing it as if it's the stupid, totally unsustainable socialist policies that have left the supermarkets with no food. But it's just not true, Tommy, is it?
It's, do you know, it's so much garbage. It gets me, Richard, because what the media in the West don't report. I had the pleasure of visiting many of the working class areas in Venezuela in 2003 when I went and visited. I posed the question to José Vicente Rangel, because at the time people were saying, is this a national revolution or is this a socialist revolution? Because it was named the Bolivarian revolution after the great liberator of Latin America, Simon Bolivar, who inspires a lot of revolutionaries across the whole of Latin America. And what José Rangel said to me was that the winds of change were blowing through Latin America. People were no longer accepting the crumbs from the table. They realized that their own natural resources, their own wealth, could be used to share it among their own people instead of continually being exploited and plundered by the US and other Western nations. And what these people have done is they've transformed the situation as far as healthcare, literacy, housing, the barrios of Venezuela, which used to be absolutely steeped in poverty. There are now new houses there. There are health programs there. There are literacy programs there. Things that were unheard of under the former right-wing regime of Venezuela, which were a disgrace because Venezuela, key to Venezuela is its oil wealth. It is next to Saudi Arabia, one of the biggest oil producers in the planet, which is why, of course, America is so interested in it. And what Hugo Chavez and Maduro are trying to do is use the oil wealth for the benefit of the people, not for the benefit of the millionaires. And that's why they're despised by the Western media.
Jonathan is on to me. I've had an email from Jonathan. And I know Jonathan, he works in finance. And his email goes, I'm very much interested in Tommy Sheridan, like reading him, but I disagree with him here, he says. He says, whatever Richie Allen says, and he's been saying it for years on his programmes, which I have, about supporting Chavez, the fact is that the government recklessly spent on the social programmes that you've talked about, that we've talked about, and that reckless spending gave way to that mad inflation and poverty and the difficulties that it faced. And Jonathan would say that's inevitable. He's not denying external influences, the determination of the United States to do what it's done, to kill Chavez, to stop all this. But he says that really the kind of spending, it's a four paragraph email, but he's alluded to previous Labour governments in the 60s and 70s who massively borrowed to spend on social reforms and then left a big bill as they left government. So in the interest of balance, thanks to Jonathan for that email, they overspent on these programmes.
What Jonathan has to address is that we currently, see, this gets me, Richard, that we get, or the people on the left and socialists get criticised because we apparently want to spend on anti-poverty measures and we want to increase the pension and we want to increase the minimum wage. And people say, oh no, you can't do that because that will leave us in debt. The UK right now is bust. The UK right now is in £1 trillion worth of debt, not on improving pensions, not on improving minimum wage, not in eradicating poverty. It's £1 trillion in debt because we refuse to chase the tax dodgers, the millionaires, the Starbucks, the Boots, the chemist, those companies which take the piss every single day. When ordinary working people are having to pay their tax through PAYE, we've got billionaires and millionaires paying accountants to make sure that their money's in offshore accounts. So we are in debt, but we're not tackling poverty. I'd much rather be in the position of Venezuela being in debt because you're tackling poverty.
Brilliant, brilliant point. Again, I know it's for some listeners it'll be boring that I'm agreeing with Tommy, but ultimately, you know, artificially messing around with the price of oil, which is still going on. I know oil is cheaper now than it has been for a while, but over the last 10 or so years, it's made it very difficult for Venezuela to do business with its oil. It's important. It's important to make that point as well. Tommy Sheridan is our guest. Check out sputniknews.com and read him. You might not always agree with him, but he's challenging. I like people who challenge you, who challenge your own point of view. Mr. Sheridan, if you are Prime Minister of a Scotland that has left the Union, is independent, has left the UK, I'm putting it to you now, Tommy, you're the man. Do you take Scotland into membership of the European Union? Straight answer, yes or no, do you?
Well, the answer is twofold, Richie. The first part of the answer is that we, in an independent Scotland, have to have our own referendum on whether we join the European Union. So that's the first part of the answer. The second part of the answer is I would argue in that referendum not to join the European Union.
Brilliant.
I think the European Union, in its current format, is nothing more than a big business club. I think it's fundamentally undemocratic. I think its structures are undemocratic, and I think it's far too much of a loss of sovereignty to allow unelected commissioners to, for instance, examine our budget, which wants to spend more on building new houses, which wants to spend more on rejigging our steel industry in order to give a boon to our shipbuilding, and wants to try and control our economy so that we put people back to work and we give them decent wages. I don't want the European Commission coming at me and saying, I'm sorry, that budget is going to be 3.5% more over in terms of incurring debt, therefore we're not accepting it. Because that's not what I was voted in to do. I was voted in to tackle poverty and to put people back to work and to create a more fair and equal Scotland. I wasn't voted in to jump to the tune of unelected European commissioners. So my argument would be that we are part of Europe, but we're not part of the European Union. That we go down the road, for instance, of a Norway which is a very successful economy, a Norway which is a high standard of life, a Norway that uses its oil to build up funds so that it can spend on big economic programs, but it does not have membership of the European Union. There is no need to be a member of the European Union. Switzerland's not a member. Iceland's not a member. Scotland doesn't need to be a member. However, here's the final part of that answer, Richie. If I lose the argument, and there's a chance I could lose the argument, 62% of Scotland voted in 2016 to stay in the European Union. I voted to leave the European Union. But if Scotland, on its own, independently, says, no, we want to join the European Union, then I'll accept it, mate. I'll accept it because my country will have voted that way. What I don't accept is that you do what England says, because that's the problem with Brexit in its current context. Quite frankly, it is undemocratic, in my opinion, for elected Labour or Tory politicians to be bumping their gums about a people's vote, a so-called people's vote. I don't know what the people's vote is about, because there's nothing democratic or people about it. Because the referendum was quite clear. It wasn't a big margin, but it was clear to leave the European Union. But fundamentally, there was then a vote in Parliament about Article 50 in February of 2017, and it was overwhelming, over 400 majority for triggering Article 50. And then here's the big fundamental difference, and the most important part, Richie, is there was an election in 2017. And if the Labour Party had stood at that election and said, vote for us, we're against Brexit, we're going to have a second referendum, and they got a 10% increase in their vote, then the people's vote would have legs. It would have a democratic basis. However, the reality is the Labour Party stood in 2017 and says, vote for us, we will implement Brexit. And they got a 10% increase in the vote. So for Labour members to turn around now and say, oh, we're for a people's vote, it's absolutely fundamentally undemocratic.
How does it make you feel as a politician? You've served, you founded very important socialist parties. When you see politicians whose own constituents voted overwhelmingly to leave in some cases, and you see them doing everything they can to prevent it happening, it's for anybody who's ever believed in the democratic process, got to be very strange times, Tommy.
It's got to be strange times because, you see, I listened the other day to a Scottish Labour politician from Edinburgh, and he argued that that we should have a new referendum, which is a Brexit 2, basically. And I got angry about it because he stood on a Labour Party manifesto in 2017. And that manifesto was absolutely clear that they would implement their Brexit. Now, I appreciate, and it's got to be quite clear that I appreciate, Jeremy Corbyn's Brexit is not the same as Theresa May's Brexit. He has a different attitude in terms of the single market, a different attitude in terms of workers' rights. I accept that. But the point is, to go for Brexit 2 does not in any way, shape or form articulate that increased 10% support. And by the way, that increased 10% support, for your listeners, they have to understand this. That was the single biggest increase the Labour Party's share of the vote at one election for 72 years, since Clement Attlee in 1945. That's how good Corbyn did in 2017. You remember, Richie, that in the run-up to that election, people said, Corbyn's finished. Corbyn's, this will do Corbyn in. Corbyn's going to get absolutely annihilated. Not only did he not get annihilated, he got the biggest increase in the share of the Labour vote for 72 years. A brilliant result for Jeremy Corbyn in England and Wales. And now you've got people in the Labour Party want him to throw it all away. To say to these people who voted Labour on that manifesto in 2017, oh, listen, I know you voted for us and I know we said we're going to introduce Brexit, we're going to do it. By the way, we're changing all of that now.
Is the answer, Tommy?
How much rubbish is that?
It's rubbish. Is the answer to that, that anomaly, why, you know, are they rolling back on those commitments to deliver Brexit? Isn't the answer possibly in that guys like you and me, we've had to look at the European Union for the last 20, 25, 30 years. I've concluded that the undemocratic nature of it might have been the point of it from the very beginning. I mean, surely it's about centralising control into the hands of a tiny few people. And what we're seeing is, you know, Labour doing this anomalous, this crazy thing. But we also saw Theresa May in 2017 introduce a Tory manifesto that I know left you, Tommy Sheridan, wiping your eyes in disbelief, going, these are not Tory policies, screwing, you know, people's inheritances later on in life. You know, their own base, basically, they were going after, taking equity out of your homes. All this stuff that the Tories would never dare say. They might do it, but they would never dare say it. It looked like May's manifesto was designed to be a disaster. So I know I'm talking conspiracy theories here, but wasn't the European Union always designed to circumvent national sovereignty?
I would argue, Richard, that some people may have had in their minds when the original European Common Market was established way back and at the end of the Second World War, you've got a situation where undoubtedly the free marketeers across Europe wanted a bulwark against socialism. They didn't want socialism expanding across Europe. And what the European Common Market was all about was creating that in 69, creating a market that made trade among free market economies easier and removed barriers. So it was seen at the time as a trading deal, an expanded trading deal. What it now is a political monster, a political superstructure. Not only is it much more than a trading deal, they now have the right to refuse member countries the passage of their budgets. That's what they did recently with Italy. They held up Italy's budget.
With Ireland.
They refused Greece's budget. They refused Portugal's budget. These budgets, by the way, were quite clearly in Greece and Portugal's basis. They were anti-austerity budgets, and the European Union says, no, you can't pass them. You look at Italy's budget, and by the way, a right-wing Italian government wants to lower the retirement age, wants to introduce a higher national living income. Things that you and I would support, Richard.
Yeah, absolutely.
And what did the European Commission say? No, I'm sorry, you can't do that because it will take your debt over the permitted 3% level. Come on, that's not what the European market was supposed to be about. It was supposed to be about making trade easier and having less tariffs and having less blockades. It is now a political superstructure, which, in my opinion, is fundamentally undemocratic. So
yeah.
That's why I'm for withdrawal from it. I lost the vote in Scotland because the people of Scotland voted to stay in it. My first thing I would do as an independent Scotland is I would be arguing for another referendum, and in that referendum, I would be arguing that we don't join the European Union. The European Union in its current state is not good enough as far as I'm concerned.
Good stuff, Tommy. Just before we talk about the blood sports and that, it's important to talk about that. I don't talk enough about animal welfare on this programme. I don't want to sound like a virtue signal, or I sounded a bit crap saying that, but I love animals, and you know, we do have a dog at home. We have had animals in the past. Before we get into that, one of the things that kills me is the media coverage of what the European Union does. It just doesn't report on it. I mean, for example, everything you said there about Italy was brilliant. Brilliant point from a socialist. For a socialist to be saying that, look, I could support this policy or these policies of this Italian government, and yet they were nobbled by the EU. You'll know this, Tommy, because you're a political animal like myself, but a lot of our listeners won't know because it isn't reported. But back in October of last year, the European Union passed measures to introduce that in the future, they'll be able to take taxes from some of the biggest countries in the world into Brussels, and the national parliaments won't be taxing these companies. I mean, that should scare the living shite out of people in who believe they live in sovereign countries, that they're going to bring fiscal revenue in. We'll tax, and it'll go straight in to Brussels. You won't do it. And there's no mention of this in the media. So what's the point, Richie? What's the point, you might say? The point is, who's going to inform the Scottish people of that in any debate about the referendum? You will, but Tommy Sheridan is not going to be invited on too many national talk shows, are you?
No.
Despite that, the fact that you're eloquent, you can speak, you can argue, that will just be kept under the carpet. Go ahead.
And it's also, Richie, you know, one of the other aspects which gets a wee bit of publicity, but not enough, is the European Union's army plans.
The army, yeah.
To have a European army. I mean, as if I've not got enough bloody military hardware and armies across the world with each individual country, they want a European army as well. I mean, it just beggars belief. And, you know, when people talk about the European Union, and it's almost as if it's a soft and cuddly toy, and it's only people in the right wing who attack the European Union. Nothing could be further from the truth. People have to waken up and smell the coffee here. It's the European Union that imposed austerity in Greece. The European imposed austerity in Portugal. And here's another thing. What has the European Union said about the brutal and bloody repression of the people of Catalan, and the fact that Catalan's political leaders are still in prison awaiting charges, awaiting trial? What's the European Union said about that? Bugger all. Absolutely nothing, because they're frightened to upset the Madrid government. And that's where it pisses me off, that they talk about, oh, the European Union is for for human rights. Aye, unless you're from Catalonia and they don't care about your human rights, they don't care about your right to vote for independence.
Brilliant. And I want to give, because I get a lot of stick when I talk about this, because people who are on the left And I mean, I was brought up on the left. These days, I don't know what I am. I say I'm nothing most of the time. But people on the left will say Richie's delusional because Richie thinks that Jacob Rees-Mogg and Boris Johnson and all of those, that they're going to do stuff for the people. As if I'm that feckin' stupid. I know what Boris Johnson wants to do. It's worse than the European Union. He wants to give the country to the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Good luck with that one. As if they're thinking, why do people, what is it with this what aboutery stuff? Just because I'm anti what Jeremy Corbyn is doing doesn't mean I have any time for Boris Johnson. Yep. Speaking of fat morons travelling around the countryside on horses, chasing animals and pulling them to pieces, how are we still talking about this in 2019? I know a lot about you, Tommy. I've followed you for years. You campaigned against this along with most decent people in the country, in the world. It was outlawed. You wrote a brilliant piece. It's on sputniknews.com, folks. I will retweet it. How is this still going on in the British countryside in 2019, torturing and terrorising animals in the countryside for sport?
Richie, I think it's shameful. I think it's utterly, utterly disgraceful. The Scottish Parliament was engaged in 1999 after we were undemocratically closed down in 1707. So we re-engaged in 1999, and I'm very proud of the fact that the first private members' bill that was introduced to that parliament in 1999 was a bill to abolish warrant sales, which was a power to allow sheriff officers, you call them bailiffs down your end,
yeah.
We call them sheriff officers, and it was to allow sheriff officers to come into your house, break down your door, take away your furniture and sell them at a public auction. And the first private members' bill that I was able to introduce in 1999 was that bill, and it was passed, and it was great. And Dennis Canavan, Labour MP, had made the point during the debate that he had sat in the British Parliament for 25 years and had tried three times to introduce a bill to abolish warrant sales in Scotland, and each time there was no allocated time for that to be debated. And yet within a year, within 12 months of the Scottish Parliament, we had abolished warrant sales. So that showed you how important it was to have that Scottish Parliament. However, the second private members' bill was to ban hunting of mammals. To ban hunting of mammals with wild dogs. Now, to me, you know, it was known as the anti-fox hunting bill, and it caused chaos up here in Scotland because you had all the landed gentry, you had all the tally-ho brigade all going mental saying, we know nothing about the countryside and these foxes have to be killed, these foxes have to be hunted. No one but no one accepts that you allow foxes to do whatever they want. If foxes are killing chickens, if foxes are killing sheep, of course you need pest control. There's no doubt about that. What you don't need is to hunt foxes down with 35 dogs, with 35 horses, with so-called adults on horses, trying to exhaust these poor wee animals so they can't run any longer, and you allow the hounds to rip them apart, and then you call it a sport. It's not a bloody sport at all. It is the unspeakable in pursuit of the uneatable. It is quite clearly, and your man, Ricky Gervais, had it to a T when he said, if you're calling that pest control, the only way it would be pest control is if the riders fell off their horses and broke their bloody necks.
Absolutely.
Then that might be pest control. And so from my point of view, Richie, it's an unacceptable, barbaric practice. It should have been banned a way back in 2002 when the bill was eventually passed. But what's happened since is there have been so many loopholes that they have managed to drive horses and carts through the loopholes so that it still takes place in Scotland, and unfortunately it still takes place in England as well. I think we have to drag ourselves into the 21st century and say that we are not prepared to accept that that is a sport. It's not an acceptable practice. And I know that in the countryside, the problem is most of the country estates and most of the owners of these country estates have got the police in their pocket, and they are able to tell the sheriffs, the local sheriffs and the local GPs what to do and what not to do. Well, I think we need to have specialised officers of the law who have got special powers to intervene in order to bring these people to book. They are not above the law. I know you've got 97-year-old Benevich driving about, ignoring the road traffic rules. Everybody else has to abide with and wearing seatbelts. But that's unacceptable. We've got to clamp down on these types of practices, Richie. And quite frankly, I think it makes a mockery of the law when you've got this type of thing going on.
And some of the, going back years, some of the world's leading psychoanalysts have often talked about, you know, and I'm going to put it very bluntly without any sophistication, but they've written about when people harm animals or get gratification from doing things to animals, it doesn't just show them in a very bad light, but it shows the sort of mental state that they're in. Now, I'm not saying that animals are more important than people. I think we're of equal importance. We have equal rights to be here and to live. But what does it say? Because many of these people are in the House of Lords. Many of these people are in Parliament. What does it say about the people ruling the country, whether it's through industry or whether it's through politics, that they get off on what is absolutely sick? It's sick beyond belief. It says a lot about them, doesn't it?
Richie, I couldn't have put it better myself, mate. These people who get delight from a wee defenceless animal being ripped to shreds in front of them, and then they all get to wipe their, smear the blood in their faces as some form of ritual. It just makes me so damned angry that they can get away with it. As I say, the law was supposed to ban it. When the law went through the various stages of the committee stage in the Scottish Parliament and the committee stages in Westminster, unfortunately, the hunting brigade, the hunting lobby, managed to get so many amendments through that they are allowed still to hunt in packs. They are allowed to use the dogs. The dogs aren't supposed to kill the animal, but they are allowed to make mistakes. You know, the dogs can do it, but as long as they say it's a mistake, then it's not against the law. It's absolutely farcical. That's why I wrote about it in my Sputnik column a couple of weeks ago. And, you know, it's interesting, the point you made earlier, and I know exactly where you're coming from. When I write my column, I tend to try and address issues which are of importance, and poverty and unemployment and the grotesque inequality of wealth and everything. And I wanted to write about the hunting bill because there was a Scottish Parliament statement recently where the Scottish Parliament announced that they are going to implement the measures that have been agreed by a lord who looked at a judge who looked at the measure, the gaps in the bill, and who said that these gaps should be filled and that there should be a ban effectively in hunting. And I thought, I want to write about that, but then I thought, oh, some people might say, oh, why are you writing about that for? There's so many other important things going on in the world. And I think it's important that we make time to write about things like that and speak about things like that, because you're absolutely right. We're on the same planet, and obviously people kill animals to eat. I know that, and some people disagree with that, and I can accept the position. I eat meat, so I'm not going to be a hypocrite. I accept that animals are sometimes killed for survival in terms of eating. But you can't eat a fox.
No.
Foxes are uneatable.
Yeah.
There is nothing that is sustainable about that. There is nothing that's justified about that. And if it is about pest control, then you can do that in a more humane fashion. There is nothing humane and nothing efficient about hunting foxes as a form of pest control.
Brilliant. And if you tear a fox to pieces and you're happy with that, you're not going to give a shite about the fact that there are over 3,500 people on the streets of this kingdom, as it's called, tonight, without anything to eat and
exactly.
Without any place to stay. I know you've always been a great advocate for speaking up for the homeless. Tommy Sheridan is our guest. It's SputnikNews.com. That's where you'll find Tommy, SputnikNews.com. He's also on Twitter. It's @CitizenTommy on Twitter. Just before we part company today, Tommy, thanks for coming back on. I'll give you a shout in a few weeks.
Pleasure.
We'll do it again with your permission, mate. What about what about a time frame? When do you think you might end up with a Scottish independence referendum? Any idea?
Richie, that, in my opinion, is going to be announced in the next couple of weeks. I'm pretty angry and frustrated that we have, in relation to the SNP, which is the government in Scotland, and who I think are doing a reasonably good job in Scotland in terms of the way they are trying to govern. We've got things which I think are important. We have free prescriptions. We've got free tuition. We don't have road tolls. We've got bus passes for our pensioners. We've got things which are important, and I think the government deserves credit for that. They fought the election in 2016 on a commitment that if anything fundamental happened to Scotland, like the withdrawal from the European Union against their will, then that would be the trigger for IndyRef 2. They then fought the 2017 election on the same platform because of the 2016 Euro referendum, Brexit referendum, where Scotland voted fundamentally 62% to stay, and we now find ourselves about to get withdrawn from that European Union. The SNP recently has been joining in coalitions with Liberals, with Tories, with some Labour people, and going on and on about Brexit 2, Brexit 2, Brexit 2. I'm afraid they never had that in their manifesto. Yeah. That was in their manifesto. And I've been angry that they've been spending an awful lot of time in this last few weeks going on about Brexit 2 and very little time going on about IndyRef 2. Well, that should change now. Ian Blackford, the Westminster leader, made a very good speech last night in Parliament, and he said that Scotland could be saved. That the only way to save Scotland was through independence. Well, I'm with you on that, Ian. I disagree in the membership of the European Union, but I can fight that battle once we're independent. What you've now got to do, and all your SNP colleagues have got to do now, is stop trying to save Britain and start trying to break up Britain. Because the British Union is the problem, not the solution. And I am now hopeful that there will be an announcement in the next couple of weeks. Nicola has promised that she will give us an announcement in the next couple of weeks on the timing of IndyRef 2. A mandate exists, Richie. It's a democratic mandate. The people of Scotland have voted for it. It exists, and it has to be used before 2021. I want it used this year. I want the referendum to take place. I would have preferred before March 29th, I've got to say to you. That's probably not now likely, but I would think by September of this year is very, very possible.
It's going to be a really interesting next few months, Tommy. I know that is a terrible cliche to end a conversation on, but it is. It's going to be a very interesting time. I've tweeted a link to Tommy's archive on sputniknews.com. Tommy's own Twitter handle is @CitizenTommy. That's @CitizenTommy. SputnikNews.com for the articles. But I've tweeted a link to where you can just see all the articles on one page, the most recent ones. Anyway, keep that up, mate. They're an absolute tonic, those articles. Get a lot out of them. Thanks for your company today.
Richie,
I really appreciate it.
It's been a pleasure as always, brother. And, you know, you and I should always, always make the point that just because you don't agree with somebody with everything doesn't mean you can't agree with somebody about some things. You know, instead of looking for 100%, why don't we look for 90% or 70%? We can still be friends. And you and I might disagree on emphasis, we might disagree on some this or that policy, but by and large, I find you a very human person, somebody who's got humanity at heart, and that means that we'll agree on most things.
Yeah, you're very kind, mate. Thanks for saying that. Have a good rest of your evening, Tommy, and let's do it again in a few weeks.
All the best to you, bro.
You too, mate. Bye for now. Tommy Sheridan, folks, live from his home. Do go to SputnikNews.com, where you'll find links to Tommy's articles. It's SputnikNews.com/authors/Tommy_Sheridan, and I've already tweeted that link out. It's 16 and a half minutes to the top of the hour. Real socialists. No, I'm not saying I'm a real socialist. I'm not. Or any